My guest today is Anderson Drew Boyd, an award-winning writer, director, producer, and editor whose new novel, The Lease of Nature, takes readers into a chillingly believable near future where medical innovation collides with criminal enterprise. Set in 2019 America, the story follows doctors Maya Copeland and Zhang Jian as they stand on the verge of a revolutionary breakthrough, transplanting 3D-printed hearts into human patients. But not everyone welcomes a future where life-saving organs can be manufactured. Standing in the shadows is the Golden Mirror, the powerful organization behind the brutal underground trade known as the Red Market. Part medical thriller, part ethical exploration, The Lease of Nature examines the dark realities of illegal organ trafficking while raising profound questions about humanity, technology, and the price we may be willing to pay for progress. We'll talk about the inspiration behind the novel, the real-world issues that influenced it, and why the moral dilemmas at the heart of this story feel more relevant than ever. The Lease of Nature is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about the book, go to theleaseofnature.com, theleaseofnature.com. And Anderson, or Drew, welcome to the show. I'll call you Drew if it's okay with you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I see how that rhymed, Drew, and if it's okay with you, it just came to me. It's absolutely meaningless, but I like to occasionally have fun with it. So, okay.
You got a poet soul.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I want to quote something that you have in the beginning of your book from David McCullough. Morality only is eternal. All the rest is balloon and bubble from the cradle to the grave. Why did you put that in the book? And what is it about your own background that led you to write this book?
I came across that. That is from the John Adams biography he did. And it stopped me in my tracks when I read it. This is after I'd been developing my story, The Lease of Nature. And I'd been looking for some epigraphs to begin the novel to kind of summate themes, feeling, tone. And it just jumped off the page because what follows is a somewhat complex exploration for some very, in my opinion, if I've done my job right, heady philosophical themes. And when I read it, it stopped me in my tracks. I loved all of his work, but that book particularly.
What's your background first? I want our audience listeners and viewers to get a sense of your background before we talk about the book itself. In a way, it's depressing because it could be such a reality, 3D printing of human organs. I mean, we have artificial intelligence at this point. So, you know, the miracles keep happening. Whether they're good miracles or bad miracles, they continue to happen in our 21st century life. But give us a little sense of your background.
Oh, that is the question. What is this going to lead to? Myself, I started, I always knew I wanted to be in a creative trade, specifically film. Early on, I had a pronounced love for it and just kind of didn't know anybody in film. I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina, so it's not exactly a company town as related to the arts.
Well, there's always tobacco studios. I'm sure that's located there.
Yeah, yeah. American Tobacco Campus right down the road. But I took it more seriously in high school. It was around that time. I think I was a late bloomer when I realized that the names in the credits of movies were the craftspeople of these stories. I grew up knowing the name Spielberg and this and that, and being excited for the next movie that would come from him, but I didn't really think of it as a craft and a trade until high school. So long story short, ended up going to University of Wilmington, North Carolina at Wilmington, which has a film school. It's a coastal city, a great film school. It just developed through the years, ended up moving to New York, fell into editing. I loved editing. And one thing led to another, worked in film freelance primarily. But at the same time, I always loved writing. It was a passion. I just pursued it on the side because I felt the need to do it. And wrote some screenplays. This book actually started as a screenplay and then developed it over many years. And around the time of COVID, everything shut down and it had started to build a little bit of steam in the festival circuits, the screenplay circuits. But everything stopped that year, of course. So I was just tired of waiting. So I was like, you know what? I don't want to sit here twiddling my thumbs. I've done enough of that. I want to take my stab at a novel. Always been a reader, and thought, what the heck? I've got time. We'll see how it turns out. And I discovered so much more about this story in the process that it became something new. Things were added, deleted, of course, but it backstories were fleshed out, and I just loved the process. So, started in film, and I found this new love in writing novels, and I hope to continue it at some point.
Well, you were involved with an Oscar-nominated film called Winter's Bone. And we'll talk about the book in a moment, but you easily segue from documentaries and fiction and writing and editing to now this book. Was it fun working on Winter's Bone?
That was a blast. That was really my entry into a sophisticated level of filmmaking. I was very lucky to get on that. It was in the first year I moved to New York. I was an additional editor on it, but I got to cut some pivotal scenes and help shape it into this neo-noir vision of the director, Deborah Granik. And it was a wonderful experience. And it was right up my alley. It's the kind of story I love. It's dark and gritty, but it got a lot of humanity and heart to it. Yes, it's kind of been a travel between fiction and nonfiction. Truth is stranger than fiction. Fiction is stranger than truth. I love both worlds, and they can be indistinguishable too. Because what better to tell us about ourselves than a fictional story that's really hitting on the heart of things, even if it's not historically accurate, factually accurate. So I love all those worlds. Yeah.
One other question before we talk about the book. In your role as an editor, I've always been intrigued because I do editing as well, but I wonder where that focus comes from. What I mean by that is there are editors who edit for art. There are editors who edit maybe because of control. For example, when I edit it to make sure my guests have it, sound and look as good as they can. Same with
You've
me.
got your work cut out for you today.
I'll be fine. I'm used to it. But when you edit, are you looking partly as a sense of control? In other words, nobody can control the universe, but when you're editing a film as you do, there is a form of control. Yes, you're subject to a producer or a director saying, no, we don't want that way, the cut that way. We want to cut this way, or you want this scene taken out. Why are you leaving it in? So you don't have total control, but is there a sense of control of a film when you're editing?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was often stated, it was an adage when I was starting out, that fiction is the director's medium, or narrative rather, and documentary is the editor's medium. And it is so true. Basically, when a documentary, all that footage is collated and brought to an editor, they're expecting the editor to really shape the story up front. Of course, the director steps in and helps massage it, finesse it, and move it towards a vision. But the editor is so crucial to the ultimate vision of documentary, and of course a narrative. But narrative, there's you're adhering to the director's vision. I've often heard that you're a part doula, part psychiatrist, and part technician when you're working a narrative. A person who's enjoyable to be in a room with for, 6 months, 8 months at a time. And you've got to let go of your inclinations. The best thing that's the most enjoyable part of the process is that when they say, here, take an editor's pass. You do a whole pass of this film, rough scenes together, assemble everything, fine cut it as much as you like, because you only get to show the director your vision, or you only get to surprise them once. So they may see things that they never considered before. But after that, it becomes very much a selective cherry picking process where the director steps in and say, well, let's do it like this. Even if you may not entirely agree, you have less control there. So there is an element of control no matter the subject matter you're editing,
But
certainly.
it's still a collaborative effort, though, right?
Oh yes, always. But I would argue probably the most outside of maybe director and cinematographer or other department heads.
One last thing, and I promise you we'll get to the book, but I'm intrigued by the subject. Do you ever look back in terms of the history of movie making, filmmaking, and realize that a lot of these award-winning films, these pieces of art, were edited on moviolas rather than the digital world, which is so much easier to manipulate?
It is astonishing. It is so impressive. So much of film grammar and film theory remains in the digital age. Like the best books I've read on editing are from Walter Murch, who edited on Moviola's, but it blows my mind that they did what we now do, what we know how to do with these nonlinear editing tools on Steenbeck's and Moviola's, piece by piece, strip by strip. It's astonishing. Yeah.
One of the films that comes to mind, well, there's two Orson Welles' films, but Citizen Kane particularly, the editing on that, but also just a random thought came to my brain, which doesn't always work, but The Bridge on the River Kwai, or Bridge on the River Kwai, when you think about that film being edited on Moviolas rather than digitally, where you can, it just seems the amount of work involved in doing it that way versus, yes, it's still work editing digitally, but it's still different and easier to move scenes around and aspects of it around.
It's not an overstatement to say it is absolutely an epic achievement. I've never actually been lucky enough to edit on a flatbed, but to think that they did that with the time, the amount of time that must have been required to a sift through that amount of footage and piece it together in such a seamless way, it's
Yeah,
amazing.
and the quality that ends up being the result is amazing. Anyway, let's get back to your book, The Lease of Nature. Now, you've created two characters that I introduced in the beginning and pretty much stumbled on the second name, but the idea is you were working on it one way, then you decided, you know what, I'm going to put this together as a book. Where did the thought come from about the 3D printing of a human organ? Where did that is that because it's been out there in a way and you thought, you know, I'm going to incorporate this with a criminal enterprise.
It did initially as a screenplay. It was primarily just focused on the black market organ trade, aka the red market. I had read an article in 2006 that really kind of opened my eyes to it. I did more and more research. Yada yada. Years went on, and I'd say halfway through its development as a screenplay, I was hearing more and more about 3D printing, particularly the medical application, what might be possible down the road. And then I said, this is an incredible counterpoint. We have this unsavory, darker side of things, the organ trade, which we don't often think about. You know, we see it in cinema,
Right.
television, but it's not a part of our daily cognition. It's not something we would like to think about. It's fairly unpleasant. Then this was a big counterpoint to that. You know, what if we could create organs, and give longer leases on life to those we love, to ourselves? It's a nice contrast between that criminal underground. But then you have the branching considerations of, well, is this entirely ethical? Are all the implications good with 3D printed hearts? And it's amazing that now the book is released. There are people, in fact, right down the road at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, there's somebody working on printing hearts right now and making steady progress. And so it was speculative fiction when I decided to implement that, probably around 2017 or 18, and now it's becoming more of a reality, and it's a strange world. It's
Well, you
every
think
day it
about
seems
it.
to.
Yeah, you think about it. If they're able to get 3D printing of hearts, then the market in the human trafficking of body parts goes away because you're able to replicate them on a 3D situation.
Absolutely. That would be a net positive, I think. Whatever else comes along with it,
Right.
that would be a net positive.
Where did the term red market come from? Because before reading the book, I never heard that term before, so I always like to educate myself and hopefully our audience as well. Where did that term red market come from?
It seemed to be a colloquial term, more or less. There have been several books that have used it in the title on the topic of organ trade, but all the many books I researched, even one of a big light post in this in the research was this congressional record from 1994, where these two defectors from China testified in front of the Senate Select Committee on Foreign Affairs, and one was a doctor, one was a prison guard, and I believe it was mentioned even then, and that's so many years ago. That term, but it's more of a colloquial term, I think.
The decision to write the book or transfer it from the screenplay on your part, did you have to modify it to some extent? And what I mean by modify, Did you have to add in a lot more detail because it's now a novel versus a screenplay?
I did, and that was an exciting part, also a very intimidating part, but ultimately beneficial because it's a whole different medium. In screenplay, you're writing present tense, you're writing as in a truncated manner. Prose is kind of discouraged, flat purple prose, or a truly evocative sense of writing. Because if you see long blocks of text on a screenplay page, you're doing something wrong. It needs to be, more a staccato kind of pace. So it was a very visual, obviously a very visual style of writing. So it was basically the perfect outline for a novel. I had it in my mind's eye. I had the plot fully laid out, of course, but actually getting into the prose writing, that was all new invention for the novel, and it was so much fun. But it was also daunting. It took a long time. I remember getting halfway through, or what my idea of halfway through was, and thinking, well, I'm one step closer to the ending than I was the beginning. And just thinking, that's supposed to sound good to me. That sounds terrifying right now, because I realize how long this just took to get to the halfway
Yeah,
point.
you have to kind of focus on the here and now, otherwise you'll never finish the book.
Absolutely.
How did you know you were on the right track? And what I mean by right track is, did you share your initial chapters in the book to friends, family, colleagues to get a sense of whether it was going in the direction you wanted it to go to?
I did. I had a pretty extensive iterative process. I made the mistake of sharing it a little early when it's what I call unsavory term, but my vomit draft. That's where you just want to
Right.
get it all out on the page, as little editing as possible. And I'd share it early and I get some encouraging things about different passages, but ultimately it was too rough. Anyway, I got to the end, edited it several times, got a couple mock proof of concepts printed up, and then I started sharing those with friends. And that's where the benefit of other eyes on it. They were bringing things that I had not seen myself. Some would be logic, connecting logical tissue. Others would be things they were very, very excited about that got them really thrilled about the story, things they didn't see coming. People who had read the screenplay and read the book and were so surprised at how different it was than what they had read previously. So it's such an important process, getting other eyes on it. If you're locked into your own, you don't have good context or clarity if you're locked into your own thinking on it, I believe.
Was there a point you mentioned earlier where you knew that you had one more step closer to finishing it, but then you realized how much more there was to finish, which can be challenging. But was there a point where further down that halfway point that you realized that you're on the home stretch, to use a metaphor, and that it was worth finishing?
Oh yes, I'd say towards the end when it all builds into this climax, we have four separate protagonists whose lives are slowly inching towards each other, and we have this villain who I won't. I think I believe you mentioned in the opening, but these lives are all coming together, and it climaxes towards the very end of the novel. There's no true denouement where it falls off afterwards. It all kind of ends at the end. And as I got to that, I would look up and it would be 5 hours later when I was writing it, and it wasn't feeling agonizing to sit in front of the blank page every day, and you'd have to peel me away from it. So when you're excited about the writing, and eventually somebody will probably be excited about reading it too. And at that point, I was very, very pleased with it.
I usually ask my guests this question because I'm always intrigued by the process. I mean, my guests who are authors, and that is, did you devote X amount of hours per day, or did you just keep writing, as you say, where because you were passionate about it and you just kept going until you reached a point where, okay, it's time for me to get some sleep? How did you set up your writing process?
I would love to expand on that because I'm so fascinated by what other people do. I always want to hear how they do it. Do they use a special pencil, or do they have a ritual?
Yeah.
Mine
They have
was
computers now, Drew. You don't need to.
Well, that's a part of it. It was kind of fluid. If I felt stale writing on the computer, which is my go-to blank page, an app called Scrivener, where you can track your word count, you can hit targets and such. My target would always be about 300 words a day. Some days it would be, I would make it to plus 1,000. One day I had it at plus 3,000, which is essentially close to a full chapter. Obviously, a lot of that's going to be edited down. Other days, struggle days, 100 words. And it's just not happening, or that's all that was really needed that day. Then if I feel like it's getting stale on the computer, I'll go to a notepad and I'll take a pencil and I'll handwrite it out. And I love that process because just the longer time it takes to actually finish a sentence with your hand, you're allowed more thinking time, for lack of a better way of putting it. You come up with, I think it's a catalytic process where you come up with things that you didn't realize were lurking there. So I would alternate. If one felt stale, I'd move to the other. I would try and keep it fresh so I didn't. So it never felt like a job. And then as for the logistics of it, I was balancing a lot of things. I was finishing my degree. I mentioned I moved to New York earlier. I never finished at Wilmington. So I was finishing my degree. I was editing a couple of short films, and I was getting my pilot's license, so I was finding time where I could to really finish it off. Yeah,
That's a lot of juggling going on. I was
that
thinking what
was.
you're mentioning about you ha writing by hand, that to me, all I think of is fatigue. I'd rather do the typing than do the writing. But if it works for people, it works for people, which is great in that sense.
Oh no, I do agree. There is a mental taxation that I would find in that handwriting phase that's not there when I'm just banging it out on the computer. So if I felt that, it was time to go back to the computer.
Right. Yeah. Me, it's more physical, the hand getting tired rather than the mind.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
That's where I
Yeah.
was going with that. Well, I'm going to challenge you because I had trouble with one of the characters' names. So I'm going to have you pronounce the name of the villain in the book again at the which I mentioned in the opening.
His alias is the Golden Mirror. The
Yes,
Golden Mirror.
but his name is.
Oh, I won't spoil his name. I think you were speaking of the other protagonist, the other doctor who
Right.
works with Maya. His name is Song Xian.
Yes, correct.
Xian?
Correct.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I was tripping on that, so I wanted you to pronounce it, make sure that we corrected it for the record. Although I might have gotten close to that. We'll see.
You sure did. I
Okay,
heard
fair
it.
enough. Fair enough. What do you think that people will get from reading the book? And what I mean by that, and the book again is The Lease of Nature. Well, I should ask, let me ask this first. Where did you come up with the title of the book?
It had many different names through the years. None good. All were none of which were good. I would say, my own harshest critic. But it took a long time to find something that fits. And I was rereading Macbeth in 2017, I think. It was guilt had overtaken me. You know, I read these in high school. I didn't really pay attention. I need to go back and read some of the great works. And the line, similar to that McCullough line, it jumped out of nowhere, and I was like, this is absolutely perfect title for this book. And I did some due diligence. I wanted to see if anything had been named that in novel or cinema form, and nothing had. And it really felt like it encapsulated the themes of the story.
Did you also do some due diligence in terms of the story itself? In other words, were there other books out there or articles about there that covered this topic in one way or the other, perhaps separately, and you actually put them together? So you had the issue of 3D printing and you had the issue of human trafficking or human organ trafficking. Maybe they didn't combine the two, and that's where your novel is unique. You're combining the two.
Mostly it was sprung from a true story, a true account. I mentioned those people who testified for asylum back in the 90s, and I did more research on that, and it was a lot of nonfiction books that I read on the topic. 3D printing, as far as that went, I was just tracking it with the news, but also reading some books just about the engineering and how it works. Less so about its relation to printing organs, or as we see in the novel, the dark side of it, printing ghost weapons, people printing rifles and pistols and weapons of all manner. at home, untraceable. So it was just this collision of worlds that I felt fit, and it risks being overstuffed with they're not red herrings, they're very important plot points that rear their heads. But no, it was mainly nonfiction. There's a couple of films that deal indirectly or directly with the organ trade. Dirty Pretty Things with Chiwetel Ejiofor is a fantastic movie. But it doesn't really, it's more of a cousin than a sibling to this story. Things like that.
Before I let you go, what do you want readers to take away from your novel? Again, it's called The Lease of Nature.
Well, as heavy as its themes are, and I do believe it is a heavy story, if I've done my job right, it's a page turner. I think there's some humor in there. There's a love story. There's a exciting climax. Hopefully, you won't be able to put it down when you make it to that final stretch. So I think it's a good beach read. But ultimately, I think it's a story that venerates gratitude and appreciation for this short time we have in this sweet life. So I think it's a it'll get your wheel spinning, I believe.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Anderson Drew Boyd, author of The Lease of Nature, available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble Bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And of course, you could 3D print it. Maybe. Who knows in this future? For everything about the book, go to theleaseofnature.com, theleaseofnature.com. Anderson, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.